Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Linda O'Brien, Chief Content Officer for Northern California Public Broadcasting. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you the distinguished speakers for our program, Reflections on the War, a film by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. A warm welcome to Lynn Novick, co-director of The War, Sasha Weinsheimer Jansen, who is the Sacramento Witness, prisoner of war, and a participant in the film, Burnett Miller, Sacramento Witness, World War II veteran, and participant in the film, and Professor David Kennedy from the History Department at Stanford University and member of the Board of Advisors for the film. Thank you all for joining us tonight. The War first aired on PBS in September, and it received an incredible response. The seven-part series looks at the personal accounts of a handful of men and women from four American towns, Waterbury, Connecticut, Mobile, Alabama, Laverne, Minnesota, and right here in California, Sacramento. It was the most watched series in the last 10 years on PBS, reaching a cumulative audience of more than 37 million people for its initial broadcast. In the Bay Area, on the first night of the series, KQED's audience outdistanced the network local affiliates with an incredible 8.4 rating, more than four times the typical audience average. Over the entire series, Bay Area audiences put KQED among the top stations in the nation for broadcast of this series. The documentary's reach continues to go well beyond its broadcast in schools and online across America. We've been collecting stories on KQED.org from Bay Area residents and have been amazed by the range of stories. I found one essay I wanted to share with you from a Marine pirate from World War II, Thelma Peck. And she said, "World War II was everybody's war. It was my war, my brothers, my cousins, my neighbors. It touched us all, and it called for a response from the entire country. Beyond geography, class, ethnicity, it made us real to each other, and it bonded us together as citizens." That from a member of our community, just one example of how this series has touched people nationally and locally. There have been many depictions of World War II, books and films, but why did this film resonate so strongly? We'll pose that question to our panelists, and again, please welcome Lynn Novick, Sasha Weinsheimer Jansen, Burnett Miller, and Professor David Kennedy. Let's begin with The War co-director Lynn Novick. You and Ken Burns have been filmmakers for 25 years. What was your personal reason for wanting to create this film at this time?
Well, as you said, there have been many, many, many films, books, articles, poems, essays about the Second World War. It's a subject that has received an enormous amount of attention, necessarily, and it should. I mean, there's no question it's a single event of the 20th century. So we're very interested in trying to do something about the Second World War, but we were very mindful of the fact that it's been covered a lot. And so we, at the same time that we were curious to see what we could do that would be perhaps new or different, we were very much aware of the fact that World War II veterans were not going to be around forever. And we felt a sense of urgency that perhaps we could find veterans and get them to share their stories with us and find the personal accounts and find a way to kind of understand a global cataclysm in personal, intimate terms through personal stories. And we were very much aware that during the war, there was quite strict government censorship, so you can't necessarily find out what it was like to fight in the war by reading the newspaper of that time. And people's letters home were censored, and they also censored themselves on purpose because they didn't want to worry their families for the most part. So one of the best ways to find out what was it actually like to live through the war would be to talk to the people who were there. And we felt we had sort of a window of time in which we could make this film. And it's already, that window's all, you know, it would be difficult to make the film we made if we started it today. Several people who are in the film have already passed away, and we're very much aware that we just had this sort of window of opportunity where veterans, for a variety of reasons, seem to be more willing to talk about their experiences than they had been in the past, and we wanted to try to get as many of those stories into our film as possible.
Lynn, how did this film change you personally? You worked on it for many, many years.
I did. I worked on the film for 6 years, and I think I went into it very naively, really not knowing that much about the Second World War. I knew the signal events, the main headlines, and that's really all I knew. I don't think I really grasped the inhumanity, the level of carnage that the Second World War unleashed on the world. And it was very difficult and painful to just meet people and hear their stories and understand or try to understand what actually happened, just the level of brutality and the level of death and loss that the whole world went through. Although it was very painful and difficult, it was also incredibly life-affirming to be in the presence of extraordinary people who were so generous to share their stories with us and to see how going through this experience had affected them and how they have lived their lives, incredibly productive and, for the most part, happy lives. Having gone through that was sort of a life-altering experience that's almost impossible to put into words, how that made me think about the human experience in a different way.
All right, and we're going to be talking to two individuals who were part of that human experience. Burnett Miller, in the film, you are introduced as the only child of a Sacramento family who was caught up in the biggest and least expected battle on the Western Front. As a member of the 21st Armored Infantry Battalion, your unit rushed across France in 4 days when the Battle of the Bulge began. Tell us about the story you told Lynn, as well as your individual experience in participating in this film.
Well, I must say, Lynn continues to say that we have to do this fast because you're not going to live much longer. That's always tough. Also, you know, Lynn interviewed me, I think, for about 10 hours. And I learned an awful lot about the war. You know, I found out watching the war series that I knew very little about the war. I knew one specific spot, which sometimes was fun and sometimes horrible, but Lynn talking to me for 10 hours, I can't believe it. How did you ever do that? And she managed to dredge up things that I'd long forgotten. I don't know how you do those things. She's a real seductress. I really think, you know, if you could have interviewed my dog for 10 hours, you could have gotten a lot of stuff. You know, it was a real shock. Of course, we had been in a place called Saint-Lazare down in southern France surrounding a group of a German submarine base, and it was a nice, gentle war. And then all of a sudden, we rushed across France and into Belgium and ran into a nightmare. And it was a terrible shock. And we saw, you know, I can remember the first night, it looked like fireworks out at the state fair. Bombs and rockets and everything going on, and thought, my God, this must be it. We did everything wrong for a long while, and we had been trained for desert warfare, and we were in about 4 feet of snow. The vehicles didn't work very well, and we dig in the snow, I think I've told Lynn this and lots of people this. I was 19 or 20, and, you know, you can do those things when you're 19 or 20. But, you know, there was a guy in our outfit, 30, and he just couldn't stand it. Not so much the danger, but just trying to live in the snow and trying to stay warm. It's a huge difference. You have to be awfully young to be able to... At the time, we were scared to death, of course, but we could stand it. Is that the answer you want?
That is exactly the answer. Thank you, Burnett. And at the same time, you were struggling with the climate, with the war. Sasha Weinheimer Jansen was in the Philippines, and the parallels are incredible. You were also a participant in the film. Your story from Sacramento in the Philippines drew from your diary as a young child. And in that journal, your description of the painful conditions for you and your family living in an internment camp the Japanese set up at the campus of Santo Tomas University in the Philippines. Why did you decide to tell this very personal account, and what was your experience as a participant in this film, Sasha?
I embraced the idea of joining this film, and somebody called up the war crew and said that there's a gal that was here during 1945 and came back to Sacramento after being a prisoner in the war in the Philippines. And I think that's what you want, and because there are a lot of us here from the same camp in the Sacramento area. However, none of us came back to this area during that time. My grandfather had a ranch in the Sacramento Valley, and he grew sugar beets and in Sacramento Valley, and also in the Philippines, he grew regular sugar cane. Now, that's how I got roped into the war, and but I just thought it was a fantastic experience. They were, the whole crew of Florentine Films were just so genuine, so passionate, and so eager for their project to work. And they did everything professionally. I mean, they just made you feel like you were the only person ever in this whole film. And it was just very unique. And I will always remember this experience for a long time. We were in the Philippines and caught up with all the other Americans and the Brits and different allied civilians. And the Philippines was under the American flag at that time, if you will remember. And so we automatically were swept up and put into different prison camps all over the Philippines. It wasn't just in Manila. And Santo Tomas University was turned in to number one prison camp for all the civilians. We had, at any given time, there was almost 4,000 people in the on the campus. And it was like a clearinghouse. Once it got too full, then they take some out and they put them elsewhere in another camp. And then as they caught more people during that 3 years, caught them up in the mountains and so forth, they would put them through Santo Tomas prison camp till it reached almost 4,000. And then they would shuffle around again. But it was a continuous process. And we ended up there until April of 1945, when we were liberated in February of 45 and came back to the States in April of 1945, to San Francisco, by the way.
All right, and we will hear more. Thank you, Sasha. Professor David Kennedy, you were an advisor to the film. You are an award-winning author and historian. From your own research into World War II, why did this particular film resonate so strongly across America? And what was your experience as an advisor?
Well, let me pick up on something that Burnett said, which reminded me of an episode that occurred in my own research for the book that I wrote about World War II, when I accompanied a group of veterans to the Solomon Islands, and we revisited the Guadalcanal campaign. This was in the early 90s, and there was a person in our group. There were 13 veterans of the Solomon Islands campaigns with me, and I and some others gave lectures about the history of the war and so on. And one of the veterans came up to me at the end of the trip, and he said, you know, he was a Navy flyer, Marine flyer, for months on end in that theater. And he said, you know, before I heard you guys lecture and before I came on this trip, he said, I thought all this time that 42 other guys and I and my squadron won the war single-handedly. And I think this, what Burnett said reminded me of it, is that even at this late date, given the momentous character of the war in the history of this country and indeed the history of the world, that even people who participated in it directly don't necessarily understand all of its full dimensions and its historical consequence. And I think that's one of the great things that this film has done, is it really stands, I think, as a very admirable work of history. It does the job of history in transporting us back into a moment that we, the rest of us, haven't necessarily lived in, and made us feel the texture, the odor, the feel and the character of that that great transformative historical moment. So I think as a working historian, I'm filled with admiration for the way the film accomplishes those kinds of historical objectives. Now, having said that, there is, however, another aspect of the war, and particularly America's relationship to it and participation in it, that the film acknowledges very, very strongly, and in fact, it acknowledges that in right up front in the narrative that introduces the very first segment, when it's set, and the script that appears on the screen, I think in every episode about the war was fought in 1,000 places and so on and so forth, but this is the story of just four towns and they're in the United States and their relationship to the conflict. So the filmmakers certainly understand the point I'm about to emphasize, but the film, I think, by its very nature, has difficulty capturing this. And it is that in the greater context of World War II as a global event, which it surely was, America's experience in that war was different from everybody else's. And the uniqueness of the American experience, I think, is something that in some larger historical perspective really needs a lot of emphasis, and it's a difficult point to grasp. And as I say, it's clear that Lynn Novick and Ken Burns understood this point because they acknowledge it right up front. But in the very nature of the film, I think it's just difficult to really come to an understanding of how different from every other belligerent country's experience was this war. As the introduction acknowledges, this country was never bombed, at least in the 48 state mainland and so on and so forth. So that's just one point that the film, by its very nature, has difficulty coming to grips with, I think.
Well, the other part of it is the focus on the four towns. And, Lynn, how did you decide to focus on those particular towns, and why? It was a different approach.
Yes, well, we were looking for a device, a way to personalize, tell this big global story, and we did very consciously decide we're just going to focus on the American experience. And we were very much aware that, you know, as we say in the introduction, American cities were not bombed, and it is very poignant. I think hopefully visually you get some sense as you see what happened to the other countries, how devastated the other combatants, many of them, were. And then you come back to America and everything's going on like life is normal, or as normal as it can be in a war that's fought many thousands of miles away. But we're hoping that perhaps other countries will also take this approach and look at their own war experiences. And we've had that response overseas already from people in Europe wanting to have a similar approach taken. But we decided to pick. We started out with the idea of picking one town, and we started with the idea that if we're going to pick a town, let's pick someplace sort of close by so we can really get to know it and spend a lot of time there. And we chose Waterbury, Connecticut, which is in the Northeast, as a place that had a huge war industry, and the whole town was sort of focused around making material for the war effort. And so that we thought would be an interesting way to see what the home front experience was like when everybody was really working around the clock to make things to win the war. And what we found was that it was pretty not difficult to find a home front experience, and there are lots of towns that had war industries. But the challenge of the film, one of the great challenges, was finding combat veterans who were willing and able to tell their stories. And there are lots of veterans, most of them were not in combat, and then many combat veterans don't want to talk about what they went through or aren't able to for a variety of reasons. So we sort of realized we had to broaden our scope and pick a few more towns so we could have a wider variety of combat experience and finding people who could share their stories with us. And so we looked to Mobile, Alabama at first because we found a memoir, which is not hard to find when you delve into World War II, but it's not so well known in the general public. It's a memoir by Eugene Sledge called With the Old Breed, and it's about his experience in the Marines in the Pacific. And it's a devastating and brilliant and sort of indelible book and really honest about what the war was really like and the razor's edge that so many combatants, so many soldiers and Marines, airmen, everyone went through who was in combat of trying to maintain their humanity in a very inhumane situation. And he's just incredibly lucid and honest about that. So we started with that book, and through that idea of going to Mobile, where he was from, we found Sid and Catherine Phillips, who were from Mobile, Alabama. Sid Phillips was Eugene Sledge's best friend, and that helped us to kind of just find our way through, at least finding some combat veterans in Mobile. And that paid off magnificently in many ways. We then decided, once we had sort of broadened our scope to say it's not just going to be one town, we wanted very much to incorporate a town that would allow us to talk about the Japanese-American experience and to really explain what happened with internment and also to show the experience of Japanese-Americans who served in the military while their families were interned. And so we chose Sacramento as a place where we thought we could tell that story. We didn't pick San Francisco or LA or Seattle or Portland, partly because they're much bigger and because we felt that we would sort of be feeding into people's preconceptions about World War II. So each of these places really are not well known for anything in particular in terms of their World War II history. We really wanted to discover for ourselves what a typical American town would have gone through. So that's really what brought us to Sacramento. And from starting with the idea of telling Japanese American stories, we found Burnett Miller and Sasha and many other people from Sacramento that helped us to flesh out that story. And then we wanted to talk about a small town experience. And we chose Luverne, Minnesota, because we met a fighter pilot named Quentin Annenson, who started his first day of combat was June 6th, 1944. And he went through most of the war in Europe and was extremely eloquent in telling what it was like to be seeing the war from above. And he was from Luverne, Minnesota. So it was a circuitous process. It seems when you see the finished film, I think it hopefully feels as though there was a master plan and that it all makes sense and has a cohesion. But when we started 6 years ago, we just didn't know what we were doing. We were going to make a film about World War II, telling personal stories about a town, and this is what we ended up with.
And we will be hearing more of those stories. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our topic, Reflections on the War, a film by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. We are joined by Lynn Novick, co-director of The War, Sacramento witnesses Sasha Weinsheimer-Jansen and Burnett Miller, and professor of history at Stanford University, David Kennedy. We have a number of questions now from our audience, and I would like to start with this question. The war documentary focused on some of the social impact World War II had in the United States at the beginning of the civil rights movement, Equal Work. What was it like to watch the social changes brought on by the war? Do you want to pick up, Lynn, and then?
Well, I would love Professor Kennedy to speak to this because he'll be much more knowledgeable than I am. But we were very much aware, having read his excellent book and some other sources, that the war is a watershed moment for the civil rights movement in the United States. And so, you know, we had a military that was segregated. Our country was segregated in many places by law and other places just by practice. And we interned Japanese Americans and you know, this was an imperfect democracy in many ways, and it's quite ironic we were fighting for freedom and democracy when we didn't really have it at home. And so just in speaking to, in particular, the African-American veterans that we met and hearing their stories and hearing about their frustrations, and also yet, even while they were frustrated, I remember Willie Rushton from Mobile, Alabama said, you know, I knew that I didn't have the rights I should have had at home, but I went over there to fight so that my son would have a better life than I did. So there was embedded in his willingness to serve a belief that America would one day perhaps fulfill our promise of true democracy. And I think the war helped to really unleash a lot of that.
Professor David Kennedy.
Well, yeah, I think you can make a pretty good argument, in fact, that the deep taproot of the civil rights movement that comes into full fruition in the 1950s and 60s actually dates back to the World War II era, in particular to the moment when the head of the Sleeping Car Porters Brotherhood, A. Philip Randolph, got himself an audience with Franklin Roosevelt in the White House, and he demanded that the new Selective Service Act that had just been passed in 1940 be applied equally to blacks and whites, that blacks be given full combat experience possibility, and that they be given equal employment opportunities in defense plans. Now, he got about half a loaf because, as we all know, the military remained pretty strictly segregated throughout the duration of the war, but blacks did get access to employment in defense plants. And many people have argued that that is the beginning of this great social movement that wells up in the post-war couple of decades and culminates finally in the passage of the great civil rights legislation of the 1960s. In fact, Franklin Roosevelt issued an executive order after being visited by Philip Randolph. It's called Executive Order 8802, directing that there be created a Fair Employment Practices Commission and that there be equal access to employment in the federal defense industries. And I think it's not too much to say that that was a kind of second Emancipation Proclamation, in the sense that it was the first time that that executive order, 8802, 1941, it was the first time since Reconstruction in the 1870s that the federal government had passed any legislation that really took seriously the protection of African-American civil rights.
All right, a question for Ms. Jansen and Mr. Miller. When you saw the final film, what were your beliefs? Were you intrigued by it? Were you surprised?
Would you like to answer? You know, I couldn't watch the whole thing at one time. It just took too long. I got awfully tired and sleepy. I was certainly impressed with the whole document was unbelievable to me because, as I said before, I learned a great deal that I thought I'd already known, but I knew very little about the war, really. And I think that was one of the reasons I didn't want to watch the whole thing at one time. I've done it piecemeal, and I, of course, have always been very intrigued with the part I was in. But aside from that, I was kind of shocked. It didn't sound like me. You know, whenever you listen to something after you've talked, it doesn't sound like you to yourself. But
we'll ask the same question to Ms. Jansen, but yeah. We also had another question directed to you about part of your story, which was finding the concentration camp and relating that story.
You know, that was a very, very difficult experience, and it had gone on for quite a while. As we were moving into Austria, we entered the war in Linz. As we were moving in, they were driving concentration camps away from us and sort of concentrating them at a place called Mauthausen, they hoped, or near Linz. And so the road was strewn with dead bodies of these poor folks who had just couldn't make it anymore. And we were in Linz the day it was announced that the war was ending, and they said there was going to be a white plane fly over it. And we all went out and looked for a white plane and got a hold of all the booze we could get a hold of around the place and drank a lot and tried to find this plane, which I don't think ever came. The next morning, we were ordered to mount up, and we were going up the river. We had no idea where we were going then. About halfway up the river, I think it took about 2 hours out of Linz to get to Mauthausen, which was a idyllic little village on the Danube. And came over the radio, we were supposed to stop and shave, which was kind of a typical Third Army order. I don't think anybody had a razor. There was nothing to shave with, but we all tried to shave and police ourselves up. And then we came to this camp, and It looked like a sort of normal prison camp from the outside. There was a gate, and over the gate they had a big sign up, "Welcome Americans." And we surrounded the camp, and outside of this facade and the main prison block, there were Quonset hut types of buildings strewn all over, lined up, and they were in a mess, and people were begging for food, and we'd give them food, and some of them get terribly sick from our food because we had only concentrated food. And my squad was assigned to go in, take over the main prison block. There were another squad went to the hospital, and squads went to various places, and we went in. It looked like a prison. And we were investigating the place, went down in the basement, and it looked like furnaces, and it looked like cordwood, and the cordwood were all bodies, and that were behind in their burning. And there was just one horrible mess after another. It was a real shocker. And we lived there for about 3 weeks, and it took about a week before the Swedish Red Cross came in to feed these people, and we did an awful job. We didn't know what we were doing, which was kind of typical of the whole war. But this was it was a tragic experience, of course, and one that I think anyone that was part of this, and lots of soldiers were, would never forget.
Thank you. Sasha Weinsheimer-Danson, what was your view when you watched the film and your personal experience?
Well, like everybody else, who were in the Philippines, I was so embedded in that part of the war. And after the war, when we came back, we tried to find more interesting information on that part of the war, because there's several places that we did not know what was happening, like in China and Borneo and Burma and so forth, while we were incarcerated. So it was, coming back, it was really interesting because we could play catch up. But one thing we didn't do solely was to learn so much about the European theater, because we were so involved in trying to connect the dots to our own experience. And I know our experience in camp was not as heavy as the military prisoners all over the Far East. However, we were in a different situation. We had anywhere from 700 to 900 children to take care of and keep out of trouble. And in a hot war, you really need to keep these kids under control. So we tried very hard to put them in, to have them in classes and ball games and anything that we could put together to keep them out of the Japanese way. And it worked because they didn't, they treated the children pretty well, but it was the adults that they were after as well. So in our particular camp, we had a lot of, we had 8 or 9 executions, and then we had a lot of interrogations from the Kempeitai, and the people that were interrogated were sent out to the Kempeitai headquarters in Fort Santiago in Manila, and they were treated very roughly as well. Some didn't come back for 6 or 8 months, and some didn't come back at all. But I think that the most interesting thing as a child, and I was there from 8 to 12 years old, but the most interesting thing as a child was to learn about the human experience, because here you are in a world that is so small and so close, and everything that you knew before had been taken away from you. So everything was changed. Your whole way of thinking changed, and I became a voyeur of the human condition. And I find that very, very interesting at this age, because I look back and think, my goodness, all these little stories keep creeping back into my mind of all these individuals who showed very interesting sidelines of behavior under duress. So that was an experience.
And just to follow up on that theme, one of the questions from the audience for you is, what kept your hope alive during your imprisonment?
Faith. And faith and rumors. We lived on rumors. And it didn't matter what it was, but it was, if it was the hot rumor of the day, that was it. And we had a PA system, and the PA system was put into place by the Japanese and the Americans, and they did announcements, issued announcements every morning where the different garrisons of Japanese soldiers would go for what part of the camp for their duties that day. And they woke us up with the same music every single morning. Like, that was good morning, until we were really sick and tired of it. And then when the Americans started coming back and the planes started bombing and we could see them coming back and with great intensity, then once in a while, the gentleman who was head of the PA system, he would sneak in another record. Like after the first bombing, he put in Pennies from Heaven. And when we heard that Hitler had died, he put in Ding Dong, the Wicked Witch is Dead. So this is how we, partly, and besides faith, this is how we lived and we made it.
Thank you. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our topic, Reflections on the War, a film by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. We are joined by Lynn Novick, co-director of the war, Sacramento witnesses, Sasha Weinsheimer-Jansen, and Burnett Miller, and professor of history at Stanford University, David Kennedy. Professor Kennedy, we have a question about the war syndrome that affected soldiers. And the question is, was the fact that World War II was more of a righteous war a reason that we don't hear as much about World War II syndrome?
Well, I don't believe the state of medical art was developed to the point it was later, and I think probably a lot of what we now call post-traumatic stress syndrome and so on did in fact afflict people in quantity in World War II. It was called shell shock in World War I. It was hardly all that novel at the time.
And it is discussed during the film,
yeah,
but it wasn't discussed to the extent that it is today.
Yeah, but your question, there's another part to your question, which is, I think, about why it is that at this late date, many people in this country remember this great conflict as the Good War. And again, Samuel Hines says in the preface to the entire production, there's no such thing as a good war. There are just wars and there are necessary wars, and this was just and necessary, but it's really, properly speaking, we shouldn't call it a good war. And I think among the reasons why this particular war has lingered so long or sunk so deeply into our national consciousness as a creditable moment and a worthwhile moment and a moment when the country really lived up to its own best standards and so on and so forth is not least of all because of the episode, again, that Burnett Miller just described. That is the discovery at the war's conclusion of the death camps and the full horror of the Holocaust being revealed to a skeptical world. Even at this late date, in this day, we still have difficulty grasping the enormity of that horror. It's why people like Steven Spielberg make movies like Schindler's List, because it still takes a leap of the imagination to grasp just the enormity of that great horror that was the Holocaust. But discovering the evidence of the Holocaust at the war's conclusion, there was something known about it before, to be sure, but when it was fully revealed at that moment, I think that absolutely ratified and clinched the argument that this was a just and necessary war. And it's interesting to speculate. Absent that particular element, if you could somehow read that episode out of the equation of World War II, would we still feel quite so unambiguously good about it? I'm not so sure.
I absolutely agree. And I think another element, perhaps, is that in the many years since the Second World War, we have not had that salutary, if you want to call it that, experience of actually achieving a great victory in a war on the battlefield in that same way. And so I think it looms large in our memories as a triumphant moment. And also the sense that we all pulled together in spite of our differences to achieve a common goal, that we long for that kind of unity as a society, I think. And so as we become more fractured and polarized, what we remember about the experience of the Second World War, that people sort of put aside their differences to work together for a common goal, makes it all the more important and significant.
And that was a thread throughout the film, that people really came together in this nation like no other war before or since. Is that the sense you had, Lynn?
Well, I think it was fairly unambiguous. Not that everybody wanted to be at war. There was a draft, so everyone who was eligible had to participate in the war. You were a man between the ages of 18 and, 30-something. So the whole country was sort of necessarily involved. But I think it's also a function of the leadership that we had at that time, that was our president was able to explain to the country why we needed to fight the war and that it was going to be a long, hard road. It wasn't going to be easy. And people, were willing to accept that. And so, it's a very different time. I think the contrast between that and today is another reason why we're so drawn to it.
Yeah, but we must remember that we were attacked, so we felt very self-righteous. I mean, there was no question about whether we were going to be part of this war, or whether it was good or bad, or anything. We were attacked. And that made it, I think, totally different.
It made it different, but yet, as you're watching the film, you see how the war went on for years and years and some of the difficulties there, and yet people kept the resolve throughout all of that.
I wasn't around here, but I know my mother was a gray lady or something or other, which she was quite proud of. My father was on a horse riding around Mather Field and looking for saboteurs, I guess. And so everybody was doing something. And they complained a great deal about when I got back, said, we hardly had any meat. But, one thing I'd like to sort of mention that maybe people are aware of or maybe not, but combat, you hardly know what the hell's going on. It's absolute chaos. Nobody really, you're not sure where you are. You're not sure where B Company is or where's the artillery, and the artillery's falling short on you, and nobody knows what's going on. And one thing that sometimes you'd think, well, the command knows. One time I was sent back with 13 prisoners to battalion headquarters. And as soon as I got there, a major and a colonel came running over and said, look at this map. Where are you guys? And that sort of typified it to me. They didn't know, but of course I didn't know where the map was. I could have said, is this Germany? Or, where are you?
Well,
it was just total chaos.
But that was the part about this film that struck me, that we heard from you. We didn't hear from the generals. We didn't hear from the officials. We really heard it from the front lines, which was remarkable.
Wonderful.
It was a different story. Is it a different story than we hear in the history books, David Kennedy?
Well, there are a lot of history books about this episode. There's a small library of them, I should think. But yes, you're surely right that the historians tend to focus on the great geopolitical and strategic and military campaign, warfighting doctrine kinds of questions. And this participant-level view of the war, I think, is very difficult to capture in a book. And again, it's one of the strengths of this film, I think. And one, as the classic saying goes, I can hardly imagine the experiences that the two of you had during the war. So we have to be grateful to the filmmakers for capturing your narratives about those experiences and making them available and accessible to us and to everybody to come after us. So it's another achievement of the film, I think, is to hold in time for later generations what it really felt like at a personal level to be a participant in this episode.
We felt that there has been and there will be in the future many explorations of what was Eisenhower thinking, where was Patton's, you know, plan. That's all fairly well documented in the written record as well, but the personal stories, people telling their own stories, are sort of ephemeral, and so that's why we really wanted to make sure we could capture those now, and we leave it to the past and future historians to give us the big picture. We hoped we gave enough of the big picture so that you understood the strategy and you understood the overall sort of tactical importance of any particular event we were describing, but then we really wanted you to feel like you were there as much as possible.
Sasha Weinsheimer Jansen, you kept a journal throughout that period. How did, as a 10 or 11-year-old child, how did you have the presence of mind to write so clearly to capture so much of what was happening?
Well, I had polio when I was a baby, and the room that was designated for us kids in camp to go to school to have classes in was way upstairs on the fourth floor. So I couldn't make it up those stairs every day. And so my mother said, okay, I want you to sit down. I'm going to gather as many papers and so forth and notebooks I can find, and I want you to keep your mind active. And please do this every day because we'll consider this as school. And so that's what I did. They were part of my recollections of pre-war, and they were my recollections of my feelings when the bombs came and when the Japanese came into Manila and so forth. And then as I started to write, I noticed as I look back now, my very sophomoric pattern of writing became more intimate and more observing. And so that's what I became. I became an observer, and tiny little things, little vignettes with other people, whether it was good or bad, that came into focus. And then also with my sister and brother, who were younger than I was, and taking care of them also, and that came into focus. So all of this was a daily struggle sometimes with me writing the book. But anyway, that's how it came about.
And the relationship with your mother, and as she continued to lose weight, and she had such a painful experience, but you wrote about it with such maturity.
Yes, she, my mother was 5'8". And she, in February 3rd, 1945, the night we were liberated, she weighed 73 pounds. So you can imagine, and I'll tell you this story. I get a little weepy once in a while when I tell it, but everybody, all the kids and all the women especially, kept one little momentum, something that they were going to wear when our boys came in. So my mother kept a half-chewed-up lipstick, and that was under her mattress. And she always told us, now when the boys come in, you be sure to give me that lipstick and reach for it and give it to me so I can quickly put it on and go out and meet our boys. So people had maybe a barrette or a piece of ribbon or maybe a blouse that they decided not to wear. And that's what we did. We waited for that day. When she was 73 pounds, she could hardly get out of bed. So my dad and I had to administer to her. That night, when the GIs came in the 1st Cavalry Division, my dad ran back to the shanty, and he said, Mom, he said, listen, our boys are here. So he scooped her up to take her out, and they got off the shanty stairs. And she said, wait, go back. So she went back and got her lipstick. And she was so weak she couldn't put it on, but my dad helped her. And they went out, and he carried her out to the main plaza. And here she was, just like a skeleton, but she had her lipstick. And the guys really appreciated the people that we met that night, the GIs, and they appreciated it.
I just would only like to say that hearing stories like that is why I became a documentary filmmaker, because you cannot make these things up. And the sort of the sense as a mother imagining, promising your children that one day those boys are going to come in, just her sense, her faith, and her ability to keep your spirits up that this is going to happen. That's why I'm saving the lipstick and the belief that it would happen. I really cannot imagine what that must have been like, but we're just so grateful to you for sharing that story with us.
We thank you. It is an incredible story, and it resonates and will continue to resonate. You mentioned young children that you're going to be speaking with tomorrow who ask questions and who really are learning about the war because of this film and all of
the words
we've
heard. Well, you know what? One thing I found out about after the war aired was all these people, young people, who were so interested and so knowledgeable about that whole episode. And they had so many questions. But you know what? They continue to call me. They continue to email me for interviews and speaking engagements and so forth. And tomorrow I have, for example, I have an interview with 4 11-year-olds in Bakersfield over the phone with their history teacher. And they have written down questions and so forth. So that's always a highlight of my day when we have young people who are very, very interested.
I wish we could hear those questions. Again, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, our topic, Reflections on the War, a film by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. We're joined by Lynn Novick, co-director of the war, Sacramento witnesses Sasha Weinsheimer-Jansen and Burnett Miller, and professor of history at Stanford University, David Kennedy. We have a question here, David Kennedy, about looking at the causes of this war. And do you believe that a political movement such as socialism could happen again in a country like Germany?
You mean national socialism, Nazism, I presume, is what the questioner intends.
I'm presuming.
Well, you know, a lifetime of studying history has led me to the conclusion that there is no imaginable human behavior that won't eventually happen or re-happen. So I think it would be foolish of anyone to say that it's impossible for something like a Nazi movement or Japanese militarism to once again infest a major nation state that would put itself on the path to leading the world to this degree of destruction. You just can't rule it out. It's a horrible thing to contemplate. But I'm afraid the historical record is just full of too many sorry episodes like that to say that we've evolved beyond the point where it could never happen again.
But has everything changed in terms of technology and intelligence and what we know about the world that we didn't know then?
Well, the technology has surely changed. It changed, in fact, the major technology that changed happened in the context of World War II is the development of atomic weapons, and that fundamentally, historically, revolutionized the nature of warfare. Fortunately, we haven't unleashed another nuclear, we haven't seen another nuclear incident since August of 1945. But I repeat, I'm afraid that my feeling is that mankind is not capable of any folly that it won't eventually commit.
All right, we have a question for Lynn Novick. What is your next project?
Well, I am at the moment working on an update to the series that we did many years ago, 15 years ago, on the history of baseball. We are going to do a 10th inning, which will cover essentially starting with the strike from 1994 until pretty much up to today. And then we're going to do a smaller series, probably 2 or 3 parts about Prohibition. And meanwhile, Ken is already working on a series on the history of the national parks that will air next year.
And another question for you, after reviewing these thousands of hours of film, what would you most like to make? What film of all of the films in the future?
Oh, that's a very good question. Well, we have in our pipeline the film that I have wanted to make for a long time, which is about Vietnam. So that's a much, in a way, more complicated story than the one we've just told here. So if we can tackle that and do a good job, I'll feel accomplished something small. I don't know, but it's going to be daunting, I think.
Getting back to World War II and the lessons learned, I would like to hear from each of you, after having participated in the film, in some senses reliving it, thinking about it, what lessons have we learned as a nation? And what was your takeaway? Let's start with you, David.
Well, I'd revert to something we discussed a little bit earlier, that revisiting the war in our minds, seeing this film, hearing these kinds of recollections, it makes one almost nostalgic, not exactly for the war itself, and certainly not for its violence and destruction, but it does make one nostalgic for a moment of great shared national purpose and national exertion in a cause that was, I think we would all agree, in the end, morally unambiguous. Again, if Lynn goes ahead and makes that film about Vietnam, there will be elements of moral ambiguity in that that will be very, very difficult to wrestle with. They just don't exist in the same degree with respect to World War II, and there's something, through all the violence and the killing and the damage and so on, there's something sweet about that historical memory, I think.
Sasha Weinsheimer-Jansen.
After viewing the war and living through part of it, I came back to the States and sort of brought myself into focus and my family into focus. And we looked behind us and saw where we had been. And we heard people saying, well, we did this and we did that and we couldn't get this and we couldn't get that during the war and we didn't have bubble gum and we didn't have this and so forth. But you know what? In the beginning, after hearing all of this, we decided that we're going to be better than that and just step right over it. But over the years, as a family, and being involved with so many of our friends who were in camp with us and who were friends pre-war, we always hashed the war. We hashed the European theater, and we talked about the Far East and the Pacific. And we came to the conclusion that even though we went through all of that and the hardship, that it was necessary. And even if we had to put our lives on the line for that, the whole trip was necessary.
Burnett Miller.
Well, I'm not sure we learned much from the war. We seemed to get in the same messes all over again. And it's hard to, it was totally different than the war since, in that the whole society was involved. And now more and more our leaders seem to want the society to go on just exactly the same, and the war to be totally apart, another entity. And so I don't know what we learned. I don't think we learned much from it. We can look back at it and be proud of some aspects of it. Certainly we turned enemies into friends. I mean, our best international allies now were our worst enemies, and maybe you can learn that you can do that, I hope. But it's a difficult question, isn't it?
Lynn Novick.
I agree with everything that has been said, so yes. I thought perhaps I'd just say something about what I personally feel like I came away from the process of learning about the war. And it was really a sense, I think, for me, a deeper understanding of what human beings are capable of in the best and the worst sense. And I feel like I was able, just given a privileged window into the human soul in a way of what people accomplished and what they did that we, you know, even the good guys, the Americans, we like to think we were the good guys, were involved in things that really are hard to justify sometimes. And I gained a deeper understanding of how morally complicated even a quote-unquote just war or good war is. There's a lot of gray once you unleash a proposition in which the main goal is to kill other human beings. Innocent people get in the way, friendly fire, mistakes, revenge, all kinds of things happen because you're in this essentially inhumane activity, uncivilized activity. And yet, from meeting so many people and hearing their perspectives, it just gave me sort of an inexpressibly complicated understanding of who we are as creatures, as animals, actually, or as beings. And that will stay with me no matter which war we're talking about. So when we're in a war today, and I'm hearing things about what's going on overseas with our troops, these things all have resonances with wars that have gone before. There's a sort of somewhat universal experience of war, no matter what the war, and then there's obviously specific experiences to particular wars. So I hope I gained a little bit more perspective than I had before.
David Kennedy, do you want to add to that?
Well, just something that has just been said reminds me of the contrast between the moment we're living in now, 2008, and the World War II era. I think, again, it was something Burnett said that cued the thought in my own mind. But we feel that a 16 million man armed force in World War II, and we were a nation of about 140 million people. Today we're a nation of over 300 million people, and the active duty armed forces are about 1.5 million. So relative to population, today's force is about 4% of the size of the force we fielded in World War II. And that goes a long way toward explaining what Burnett said about how today we can go to war without breaking a sweat, essentially. And if you look at the fiscal or economic side of the picture, it's quite the same thing. The portion of GDP, gross domestic product, of the nation's output that went to war fighting in World War II in the last 2 years of the war, 1944 and 45, was about 40% of the entire economy was dedicated to the war effort. Today, even with a Defense Department budget of well over $500 billion in a $13 trillion economy, again, it's about 4% of GDP goes to the present military adventures that we're engaged in. So there's a deep reality, a demographic reality and a fiscal and economic reality that underlies what Burnett said, that today we make war differently, and it doesn't draw on the society. It doesn't require things of the society at anywhere near the same degree that World War II did.
Is the intelligence there now, today? And was it there in World War II?
Well, you know, in this case, I'm a believer in collective intelligence and in the collective intelligence of the society as a whole. And one of my pet observations about the current situation is that just because of this configuration of the armed forces, that we live in an era when it is it's easier for the public in general to be disengaged from the decision to shoulder arms and to wage war. It was impossible to be disengaged in World War II. The whole enterprise made such deep claims on the society that everyone's attention was focused on it. Today, it's easy to lose track and to lose interest in what's going on in this field.
And yet we're more connected, in a sense, because of technology and communications. But yet people, you're saying, were more connected during World War II in that sense.
Yeah, I don't know that we're more connected. I think we're actually more fragmented today. We have so many different sources of information and media and just ways to think about the world. And so you have people who believe a certain ideology watching a certain television channel or going to a certain blog, and other people who disagree. And so we don't even agree on the basic facts of what's actually happening in the war that we're involved in right now. Are we winning? Is something working? Is it not working? What are the casualties of Iraqis? We don't know because there's no agreement. So I think we have sort of a deluge of information, but we don't have actually unity of understanding.
And we just have 2 minutes remaining. And in that time, if you could reflect, getting back to the topic of this panel, the reflections on the war, the film. Lynn, let's start with you. Just one quick reflection.
Well, we've just been humbled and incredibly gratified to see the response to the film. We've had incredibly powerful feedback from viewers all over the country, and it really seems to have touched a lot of people, and that's why we made it, so that people could watch it and hopefully be engaged in this personal stories and in what the story we were telling. So it's been sort of a, I don't know, out-of-body experience, actually, for all of us that have worked on the film. And we just feel very lucky that we got to be involved.
Burnett Miller.
Yeah, I consider it a real privilege to be part of it. I think it's an important document that will last for a long time and hopefully will do a lot of education to kids that at the present time many think is war is a computer game, and this will show them the true thing, I think. I think it's been very valuable.
Sasha
Weinstein. I think that's why we have a lot of interest, and I will reiterate, the younger people show so much interest, and I just think that is because of the artistic endeavor of Mr. Ken Burns and Lynn Novick and their staff, and hopefully that everybody will be able to see this eventually.
And well, I repeat, I think it's a wonderful achievement, this film, but I revert to a point I made earlier that I wonder how the narrative would be different and its effect on us would be different if there were a fifth city, let's say, Coventry, Hamburg, Dresden, Stalingrad, Hiroshima. Would we understand a different story if one of those chapters had been there?
Well, Lynn, could there be?
A point well taken. That would have been wonderful to do. And I think we feel we didn't really have actually the expertise to do it in a way. And so we sort of put our blinders on. But I absolutely agree. I think that would be fascinating. I would love to see it.
All right. Well, maybe we'll see it in the future. Thank you all for joining us tonight. To our panelists, Lynn Novick, Sasha Weinsheimer-Jansen, Burnett Miller, and Professor David Kennedy. We would also like to thank our audience here and on the radio. I'm Linda O'Brien, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.